And hello, Sun's House listeners. This is Andy Bombeck, which means once again it's time for the Children's Story Hour. And as always, I'm glad you could join me today for a good variety of children's stories. Like always, the first half hour, I'll be reading picture books. And then the second half hour, I'm going to continue with the novel that I've been only reading now for a couple weeks, titled Angus, who is a cat, Thongs, and Full Frontal Snogging. Snogging is kissing. Confessions of Georgia Nicholson. All right, but first let's begin today's program with the picture book titles. I'm going to start off with a book titled Paper Planes. And then it's The Class with Wings. These Olive Trees, A Palestinian Family's Story. Northbound, A Train Ride Out of Segregation. The 11th Hour. And if we have time, I'll finish up the first half hour with Mommy Crumbs. So it should be a lot of fun. Let's get started with our first picture book today, titled Paper Planes. Mia and Ben were the very best of friends. They lived side by side on the edge of a great wide lake. They sailed together and swung and sang together. But what they loved doing most of all was making planes, paper planes. In the winter, Mia and Ben would race their planes with the geese above. And in the summer, they would climb into the hills and toss their planes down below, watching them glide home. Mia and Ben were determined to make a plane that could fly all the way across the lake. But it wasn't mean to be. Ben had terrible news. He was leaving. His family was moving to a new home, a long way away. Mia and Ben were crushed. How could they stay best friends if they were so far apart? They promised to never forget one another. And they swapped planes as they said their goodbyes. As the days passed, Mia missed Ben very much. She thought of him way over the sea and wondered if he was lonely too. Winter came again. But when the geese returned this time, Mia had no one to race planes with. Hot tears fell from her eyes. Mia and Ben would never make a plane that could fly across the lake now. Mia took the plane Ben had given her and smashed it on the ground. She went to bed feeling hurt and angry. That night, as moonlight crept across her bedroom floor, Mia heard something. Was it the wind? No, it was the sound of distant geese calling and powerful wings beating. Mia crept out of bed and spied something odd with her telescope in the garden below. Why, it was the plane she had smashed, as good as new. Mia hurried outside for a closer look. The swish and chatter of geese grew louder, and a wild wind began to blow. As the wind whipped around Mia's plane, it grew big enough to climb in. Suddenly, a huge gust whisked Mia and her enchanted plane into the air, up across the lake and away. Climbing at terrific speed, Mia joined a flock of geese. Their silver feathers gleamed in the light of the moon as they rushed through the night. Up ahead, Mia spotted something familiar in the distance. Could it be? Yes, it was Ben, waving and smiling. Together they swooped and skimmed and soared. Mia wished she could stay forever. But as the sun began to rise, she knew it was time to go. And in the beat of a wing, Mia woke up and found herself back in her bedroom. At breakfast time, a package arrived for her. Inside was a brand new plane. but it had no wings. And there was also a note. "Dear Mia, I really need your help to finish this. No one else can make wings like you. Love, Ben." Mia remembered her dream with Ben and the geese. Ben might be far away, but that didn't mean Mia had lost him forever. So she sat down at her table and got to work on the wings Ben had asked for. Mia thought of the geese with their long necks stretching and their wide wings beating. And over the weeks, she worked and she worked and she worked. In the springtime, it was finally ready. Mia fixed her wings onto the plane Ben had sent her and went down to the water's edge. She threw the plane up into the air and it soared, higher than any plane she and Ben had ever made before. Mia and Ben could still make planes together, the best planes in the world. And they would always stay friends. For now, not even an ocean could keep them apart. The Class with Wings. I can't wait for the clock to tick and reach 2:30. Miss Lee pulls the curtains over the windows. Then she turns off the lights. She starts the audio of rainforest sounds. We put our heads on our arms and close our eyes. Then we become birds. We're varies, sort of like robins but smaller. "For months, you've been in Brazil," says Miss Lee. "Lately, you've been extra hungry. You've been gobbling down fruit because it has seeds, and seeds have energy. You're storing up all you can." "I'm going to start eating sunflower seeds so I can win the 50-yard dash." "It's April now. Some of you are practicing your song." Miss Lee plays a very song on her phone. The notes go downward and sound like they come from a flute. "You feel jumpy and can't sit still. That's just what my mom said about me last night." The sun sets. You'd normally pick out a branch to perch on for sleep, but tonight will be different. You're ready. I hear Miss Lee's feet getting closer. Then her finger touches my elbow, and my arms become wings. One by one, you burst up through the trees. I'm flying higher and higher. The stars that had been hidden by the forest fill the sky. They help us point north. You're heading back to the United States and Canada, where you were born, where it's easier to catch the huge number of insects you'll need to raise your own young. Other kinds of birds are flying with us. We call to keep from bumping into each other. Because you live near the ground in dark woods, your eyes are large to let in more light. This gives you good night vision. I have big dark eyes too. Other birds glide for a while to rest, but you can flap all night without stopping. Your wings are only 4 inches long, but you're strong. I'm always the smallest kid in class. I want to be like a very. On and on you go. When dawn gets close, you start to come down. You need a forest for food and a safe place to rest. But the trees here have all been cut down for farms. You keep flying, then find woods along a stream. Your feet finally touch the ground. Then the stupid bell rings. We've gone 168 miles. I get to mark on the map where we're spending the night. The next day, we study South America's mountains and rivers. Then Miss Lee lets us fly. You always fly at night, when fewer hawks and falcons are around. They're migrating too. School kids have bullies. Varies have raptors, except raptors eat you. Look down, says Miss Lee. That's the Amazon, miles across. Red with the soil from the Andes Mountains. We cross the Orinoco River. We see two jaguars in the moonlight. One day, when we land, I hear something strange. Miss Lee's changed the recording. It's the sound of waves. We've reached the Caribbean Sea. To cross over, you'll need to replace all the fat you just burned. So you rest for 3 days, gorging on food. In class, we spend those days studying weather. When a storm passes through, we look at the flag out the window. The wind changed direction, just like we learned. Flying into the wind would make crossing the Caribbean too hard, says Miss Lee. You need a wind from the south. My eyes are closed, but I think she's turned on a little fan. I feel the air on my cheek. Then she touches my elbow. Up you go, everyone, she says. There's a storm behind you. It'll help you fly faster. There's no place to land, so you have to flap all night, all day, and all night again. If my side aches when I'm running, I stop. But the Veeries can't do that. I peek and see the boy next to me making little circles with his hands. You make the long crossing to the island of Cuba in a single flight. We measure it on the map. It's practically 1,000 miles. Birds that couldn't find enough food when they rested don't have enough energy and fall out of the sky. 2 days later comes another flight over water, 700 miles over the Gulf of Mexico. When you touch down this time, says Miss Lee, you're in Louisiana. People who spot us can't see our life in Brazil or our long flights. I wonder what my grandmother's life was like in Vietnam. Was her trip here dangerous? You are strangers here. You try to stay close to the local birds because they know the dangers. When one gives an alarm call, you hide in a bush. Suddenly, Miss Lee tells us that someone's dogs are chasing us. The energy it takes to fly away from the dogs is energy you needed to keep flying north. You'll have to replace it by spending extra time finding food. I've never thought about it that way. I need to explain this to my dad, since we have dogs. Well, you've still got a long way to go. It's 1,200 miles up the Mississippi River from Louisiana to Wisconsin. Miss Lee shows us a website where people all over the world list the birds they've just seen. A bunch of people in Louisiana saw Veeries yesterday. That's us! You're moving north with millions of other birds. Since you travel at night, most people don't know there's a bird river over their heads. But if you live somewhere quiet, Miss Lee says, you might hear the birds calling. You're attracted to light, but be careful not to crash into lit-up windows. Some kind people are working to get cities to have fewer lights on in big buildings when migration is at its peak. People see us in Arkansas, then Missouri and Illinois. Then, finally, we're back in Wisconsin. You only weigh an ounce, the same as a pen, but you've flown over 3,000 miles. Very impressive. To celebrate, Miss Lee has set up a field trip to a state park. She passes out binoculars and fold-out guides to local birds. Fields have different birds than forest. Some live high up and others down low. We're near a creek when I hear a bird sing. Its notes sound like they're going down a spiral staircase. I look ahead on the trail, and there it is, hopping on the ground, just like we'd learned. It flips over a leaf looking for bugs. Its wings really are the color of cinnamon. I can't believe that I'm seeing something that has seen jaguars and heard monkeys. Then it turns its head, and its big black eyes look right into mine. I think it knows I'm a veery, too. These Olive Trees, a Palestinian family's story. Every year, Mama harvests the olives right outside the refugee camp where Oreb and her family live. This year, as she prunes the olive grove under a sky of infinite blue-gray, Oreb wonders about the first person to ever taste the small, oval fruit. She imagines them picking the olive and biting halfway down into its savory center. They must have waited years for the tree to produce even a single fruit. Did they like how it tasted? Oreb thinks they must have hated it. Olives don't always taste very good directly from the tree. They can be quite bitter at first. Or maybe, Oreb ponders, they were pleasantly surprised by its acidity. Oreb is always too impatient to go through the weeks-long process of curing and brining the fruit, the way her mama taught her. Too eager to taste the olive straight from the tree, she ends up disappointed by the bitter taste. But sometimes the olive surprises her, and she finds joy in the bitterness. After all, with work and patience, these bitter olives can be used to make so many things. In the refugee camp, they use the trimmings from the trees to light fires and to make ornaments and tools. They press the oil from the olives to cook and even to make soup. Sometimes her life in the camp surprises her, too, and she finds happiness in the sorrow around her. Mama passes the olives to Oreb, who always helps her family in the grove. It's odd that we're gathering the olives so soon, Oreb thinks to herself. It's not harvest season quite yet. Still, Oreb prepares herself to stomp, stomp, stomp on the olives, as she always does, to remove their pits and pour their oozing liquid into pressed bags. But her mama stops her. "We are not cleaning or crushing any olives today," says Mama, "just packing them to go." "Go?" Mama nods. "Go." Mama and the rest of their family used to live in a village called Altira by the coast of Palestine. Generations of her family had tended the olive trees there, too, for hundreds of years. But one day, before Oreb was born, the war came. They carried what they could and walked for many days until they reached the other side of the country to escape it. But they couldn't save their olive trees. Since then, they have lived in a makeshift canvas house in the Balta refugee camp near the city of Nablus. Oreb and her younger brother and sister were born here. The camp is the only home she's ever known, and there are more olive trees here. Oreb and her mama walk back from the orchard, carrying the olives and tree trimmings, but within the camp, piles of blankets and boxes now line the rows of tents. Families frantically load trucks with bundles of wrapped canvas. "Are we going on a trip?" Oreb asks. "Yes, dear." Mama's eyes look misty. "The war has come to our doorstep again, even in Baltia camp." The sky is gray, and the earth is damp with the knowledge that the war has found its way to Nablus. Where are we going? Do we have to go? Oreb asks Mama. Mama pauses. I don't know where, but wherever we go, we have each other. But what about our house? What about the olive trees? We will have a new tent. As for the trees, says Mama, we can't save them. Mama follows Oreb's siblings into the tent, helping the rest of the family gather their belongings. Alone outside, Oreb looks at the olive pits lying around their tent, the pits they had prepared to be planted in the fall. We can, she declares. I will borrow an olive and plant its seed. She is sure the earth would not mind. She looks to the sky. May I borrow your rain? She is sure the clouds would not mind either, for it may be the last time she sees the sky above her home for a while. After all, someone needs to look after the land so their olive trees live on. Gently, she plants a pit. Although olive trees take a long time to grow and even longer to produce olives, Oreb decides that for once she will be patient. Wait for me. One day, when we're older, I'll return to you for harvest. Northbound, a train ride out of segregation. Trains, the clickety-clack of the wheels and the low song of the whistles. As the huge engines rushed by our farm, Granddaddy and I always stopped our work to watch and to dream of climbing on board a powerful train and traveling to distant, strange places. And then one day, I got what I wanted the most. Grandma was taking me for my first train ride. We were going north, all the way from Alabama to Ohio, to visit my cousins. The station was crowded with all sorts of people. The train was much bigger up close. It was huge. All aboard, the conductor shouted. All aboard, I shouted back. The conductor directed me and my grandma to the colored-only train car. Suddenly, the train jerked forward. The wheels squealed and squeaked as we slowly got underway. Woo, woo, the whistle sounded. Woo, woo, I shouted back. The train moved faster and faster. I pressed my face up against the window to get the best view. At first, we passed farms and little towns like ours. Then we sped through tunnels. We practically flew over bridges. Soon we were zooming by places that didn't look like anything I had ever seen before. It was like I was seeing a movie, but it was real. Now all I wanted was to explore the whole train. My grandma was so tired she fell asleep, so I crept past her and started up the aisle. The train swayed so much, I had to hold on to seats as I made my way to the front of the car. Through the window, I saw the boy who had gotten on at our station, but I was not allowed in his car. Next stop, Atlanta, Georgia, shouted the conductor as he trudged through our car, punching tickets. Atlanta, Georgia. I had never seen so many different kinds of people all in the same place or such giant buildings. Even if I was only seeing them through the train window, I was in heaven. As we pulled out of the Atlanta station, the conductor came through and took the sign down from the door. I was so surprised. And the sign says, colored only, no whites allowed. It seemed as if I could go right through to the next car now. I guess Atlanta had some different rules from home. Then the boy I'd seen before suddenly entered our car and ran up to me. "Hi, I'm Bobby Ray," he said. "I'm Michael," I said. "Do you want to explore?" Bobby Ray asked. I looked at my grandma to see if it was okay. She nodded, and I said, and she nodded and said, "Y'all be careful now." "Yes, ma'am," I shouted, as Bobby Ray and I raced to the next car. Going from train car to train car while the train was moving was a little scary. It was loud, and the platform moved back and forth. It was kind of hard to keep your balance at first, but after a few times, it was easy for us. We rushed straight through the cars full of folks sitting and came upon a car with bunk beds stacked up behind curtains. Amazing! People must sleep in those beds at night. Then we came to a car that looked like the fanciest restaurant I had ever dreamed of. A waiter there told us he had worked on the trains his whole life. I guess he'd been just about everywhere. This train was full of surprises. When we got back to Bobby Ray's car, I was surprised to find lots of empty seats. "Who's your new friend?" asked Bobby Ray's mom. "Michael," Bobby Ray said. "Go on, have a seat, Michael," she said. I sat down, and Bobby Ray and I talked and talked. Turns out, Bobby Ray was just my age and even lived in the same town as me. Though we'd never met before, that's probably because where we lived, there were schools for people like Bobby Ray and different schools for people like me. Bobby Ray really liked my collection of special Green Army men. I sure didn't let just anyone play with them, but Bobby Ray was my new friend. Bobby Ray had lots of drawings of trains. He was a really good artist. And we both had scars. Mine was on my elbow from when I fell out of a tree. His was on his knee from slipping on rocks by the creek. "I'm making something for you," Bobby Ray said. "What is it?" I asked. "It's a surprise," Bobby Ray said. "You'll see." But then the fun stopped. The conductor shouted, "Chattanooga, Tennessee, next stop." Then he put the whites only sign back up in Bobby Ray's train car. Bobby Ray handed me a rolled up paper with a rubber band wrapped around it. But I didn't have time to look at it. The conductor whisked me down that aisle darn fast. "That ain't fair, mister," said Bobby Ray. The conductor just grinned and looked back at him and kept moving me away. Seemed like the rules on that train were always changing. It just didn't make any sense at all. The next thing I knew, it was dark, and Grandma was shaking me awake to see Cincinnati, Ohio. The train went over a long bridge. The glittery lights of the giant buildings looked like diamonds on the water below. The signs between the cars had been taken down. I didn't think I would ever experience anything as magical as that first train ride to Ohio, but I was wrong. What I was about to see would stay with me forever. In the drawing Bobby Ray gave me, I saw white folk sitting next to black folk in the same train car. Of all the surprising new things I had seen on my journey, that was the most wonderful. And this is just a reminder. My name is Andy Bombeck, and I hope you're enjoying the Children's Story Hour. And as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, for the second half hour, I'm going to continue reading a novel that I've been only reading now for a couple weeks, titled Angus Thongs and Full Frontal Snogging, Confessions of Georgia Nicholson. I'm a facsimile of a sham of a fax of a person. Georgia Nicholson's life is far from simple. Her cat, Angus, is the size of a small Labrador. Her 3-year-old sister may have peed somewhere in her room. And her best friend, Jazz, thinks she looks like an alien just because she accidentally shaved off her eyebrows. Enter the sex god. This just might turn out to be the most fabbity-fab year ever. Okay, last week, Elizabeth, who's 14, did actually shave off her eyebrows. She talked about kissing with her friends. And that's where I left off last week. September, Operation Sausage. Tuesday, September the 1st, 10 a.m. 6 days to school and counting. I wish my mom could be emancipated, a feminist, a working mother, etc., and manage to do my ironing. I thought I'd wear my pencil-lined skirt the first day back, with hold-up stockings and my ankle boots. I'm still not really resolved in the makeup department because if I do run into Hawkeye, she'll make me take it off if she spots it. Then I'll get that shiny red face look that is so popular with PE teachers. On the other hand, I cannot possibly risk walking to school without makeup on. No matter how much I stick to side streets, sooner or later I will be bound to bump into the lads from Foxwood School. The biggest worry of all is the bloody beret. I must consult with the gang to see what our plan is. 5 o'clock p.m. We have an emergency beret and other forms of torture meeting Friday at my place again. I have got eyebrows now, but still look a bit on the startled earwig side. 7 p.m. After tea, when Dad was doing the washing up, I said casually, "Why don't you wear your special apron, Dad?" He went ballistic and said I shouldn't be prying through his drawers. I said, "I think I've got a right to know if my dad is a transvestite." Mom laughed, which made him even madder. "You encourage her, Connie. You show no respect, so how can she?" Mom said, "Calm down, Bob. Of course I respect you. It's just that it is quite funny to think of you as a transvestite." Then she started laughing again. Dad went off to the pub, thank goodness. Mom said, "It's his messianic apron. You know, that huddly-duddly pulling up one sock. I'll scratch your back if you scratch mine sort of thing." I smiled and nodded, but I haven't the remotest idea what she is talking about. 11:30 p.m. Why couldn't I be adopted? I wonder if it's too late. Am I too old to ring Esther Ratzern's helpline? I might get Esther. Good grief. Wednesday, September the 2nd. 5 days to purgatory. 10 a.m. Oh no, it's here already. As a special treat, my cousin James is coming to stay with us overnight. I mean, I used to like him, and we were quite close as kids and everything, but he's so goofy now. His voice is all peculiar, and he's got a funny smell. No hammerish like Libby, but sort of dodgy cheesy. I don't think all boys smell like that. Perhaps it's because he's my cousin. 2 o'clock p.m. James actually not such bad fun. He seems much younger than me and still wants to do mad dancing to old records like we used to. We worked out some dance routines to old soul records of Mom's. Reach Out, I'll Be There by the Four Tops was quite dramatic. It was two pointy points, one hand on heart, one hand on head, a shimmy, and a full turnaround. Sadly, there's not much room in my bedroom, and James trod on Angus, who, as usual, went berserk. Actually, it would be more than unusual to say Angus went calm. Anyway, he ran up the curtains and finally got on top of the door and crouched there hissing. Angus, that is not James. We tried to get him down, and also we tried to get to the bathroom, but he wouldn't let us. If we tried to get through the door, he'd strike out with his huge paw. I think he is part cat, part cobra. In the end, Mom got him down with some sardines. 7 p.m. After tea, James and I were listening to records and talking about what we were going to do after we ditch the olds, as we call our parents. I'm going to be a comedy actress or someone like those It girls who don't actually do anything except be It. The newspapers follow them all day, and the headlines say, "Oh, look, there is Tara Pompey to Bobby going out to buy some biscuits," or "Tasman Snaggletooth Polyplops goes skiing in fur bikini." And they just make money from that. That is me. That is. James wants to do something electronic, whatever that means. I didn't encourage him to explain because I felt a coma coming on. He wants to travel first, though I said, "Oh, do you? Where?" Thinking Himalayas, yak butter, opium dens. And he said, "Well, the Scilly Isles in particular." 11 p.m. Something a bit weird happened. We went to bed. James slept in a sleeping bag on some cushions on the floor. And we were chatting and so on. And then I felt his pressure on my leg. He had reached out and held my leg. I didn't know what to do, so I kept really still, so that he might think he'd just got hold of a piece of the bed or something. I stayed still for ages, but then I think I must have dropped off. Thursday, September the 3rd, 9 a.m. At last, the eyebrows are starting to look normal. 2 p.m. James went home. The leg incident was not mentioned. Boys are truly weird. 9 p.m. Libby has the flu. She was all pale and miserable. I let her sleep in my bed, and she was snuffling, poor thing. Poor little thing. I really love my little sister. 8:30 p.m. Took Libs some hot milk and thought she might like me to read The Magic Faraway Tree. She said, "Yes, now, more, please," and sat herself up in my bed. Then, as I opened the book, she took my duvet cover and blew her nose on it. It's absolutely covered in green snot. Who would have thought such a tiny girl could produce a bucket of snot? 10 p.m. I had to sleep in the sleeping bag. What a life. Friday, September the 4th, 11 a.m. Emergency beret and other forms of torture meeting to be held this afternoon. I've decided that my eyebrows have recovered enough to venture out, obviously not on their own. I feel like one of those blokes who have been held in solitary in a cellar and come out into the daylight blinking. We go to Costa Rica's for cappuccino. I hate cappuccino, but everyone drinks it, so you can't say no. I haven't been out for weeks, well, 5 days. Town looks great, like New York, but without the skyscrapers and Americans. We decide we'll have the meeting and then go and sneak a look at the boy that Jazz likes, Tom. He works in Jennings. I said, "What? The grocers?" Jazz said, "It's a green grocer cum delicatessen." And I said, "Yes, well, it sells hummus." And she said, and yogurt. And I said, que domnage? I forgot the yogurt. Yes, it's like going to Paris, going into that shop, apart from the turnips. Jazz sort of went red, so I thought I would shut up. Jazz doesn't get angry very often, but she has a hefty kick. Jules said, shall we talk beret plan? At our stupid school, you have to wear a beret with your outdoor uniform. It's a real pain because, as we know, everyone, and especially the French who invented it, look like a stupid prat in a beret. And they flatten your hair. Last term, we perfected a way of wearing it like a pancake. You flatten it out and then pin it with hair grips right at the back of your head. Still a pain, but you can't see it from the front. Ellen said she had made up a different method called the sausage. She showed us how to do it. She rolled her beret up really tight like a little sausage and then pinned it with her hair grips right at the back in the center of her head. You could hardly see it at all. It was brilliant. We decided to instigate Operation Sausage at the beginning of the term. It has been a constant battle about these berets. The so-called grown-ups will not negotiate with us. We sent a deputation to the headmistress Slim, so-called because she wears 25 stone, at least. Her feet cascade out of her shoes. At the deputation, we asked why we had to wear berets. She said it was to keep standards up and to enhance the image of the school in the community. I said, but the boys from Foxwood call out, have you got any onions? I don't think they do respect us. I think they make a mock and a sham of us. Slim shook herself. It was sort of habit that she had when she was irritated with us, i.e. all the time. It made her look like a jelly with shoes on. Georgia, you have had my last word on this. Berets are to be worn to and from school. Why not think about something a bit more important, like perhaps getting less than 21 poor conduct marks next term? Oh, go on, play the old record again, just because I am lively. Well, we did have another campaign last year, which was, if you want us to wear our berets, let's really wear our berets. This involved the whole of our class pulling their berets right down over their heads with just their ears showing. It was very stunning seeing 100 girls at the bus stop with just their ears showing. We stopped eventually, even though it really infuriated Slim and Hawkeye, because it was terribly hot and you couldn't see where you were going, and it played havoc with your hair. Beret meeting over and time for boy stalking. Jazz was a bit nervous about us all going into the shop. She's not actually spoken to Tom, well, apart from saying 2 pounds of greens. We decided that we'd lurk casually outside, and then when she went in to be served, well, we'd sort of accidentally spot her and pop into the shop and say hi. This would be casual and give us the chance to give him the once-over and also give the wrong impression that Jazz is a very popular person. Jazz popped to the loo to make herself look natural with concealer, etc. Then she went into Jennings. I gave it 5 minutes, and then I was the first one to walk by the shop doorway. Jazz was talking to a tall, dark-haired boy in black jeans. He was smiling as he handed over some onions. Jazz was a bit flushed and was twiddling with her fringe. It was a very irritating habit she had. Anyway, I stopped in my tracks and said, in a tone of delight and surprise, which convinced even me, Jazz, hi. What are you doing here? And I gave her a really warm hug, managing to say in her ear, leave your bloody fringe alone. When I stopped hugging her, she said, hi, Georgie. And I was just buying some onions. And I laughed and said, well, you know your onions, don't you, Jazz? Then Ellen and Jules came in with arms outstretched and shrieking with excitement. Jazz, Jazz, how lovely. Gosh, we haven't seen you for ages. How are you? Meanwhile, the boy Tom stood there. Jazz said to him, oh, I'm really sorry to keep you waiting. And he just went, it's cool. And Jazz asked him how much she owed him. And then she said, bye then, thanks. And he said, see you later. And we were outside. When we got a few meters away, we didn't say anything, but sort of spontaneously all started running as fast as we could and laughing. 7 p.m. Just spoke to Jazz on the phone. She thinks Tom is even more gorgeous, but she doesn't know whether he likes her. So we have to go through the whole thing. I could hear Jazz's dad in the background saying, well, if you are seeing each other tomorrow, can't you wait and not add to my phone bill? Parents are all the same, all skinflints. Anyway, Jazz said, he said, see you later. I agreed, but added thoughtfully, but he might say that to everyone, like a sort of see you later sort of thing. That upset her. You mean you don't think he likes me? I said, I didn't say that. He might never say see you later unless he means see you later. That cheered her up. So you think he might mean see you later then? I said yes. She was quiet for a bit. I could hear her chewing her chewing gum. Then she started again. When is later, though? Honestly, we could be here all night. I said, Jazz, I don't know. Why don't you decide when later is? She stopped chewing. Then, you mean I should ask him out? I could see my book sort of beckoning to me, saying, come and read me. Come and read me. You know you want to. So I was firm but fair. It's up to you, Jazz. But I know what Sharon Stone would do. Good night. Saturday, September the 5th, 10 a.m. Same bat time, same bat place. 10:15 a.m. Jazz called. She wants to lunch Operation Get Tom. We're going to go to Costco's for more detailed planning. 10:30 a.m. La, 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 la. Life is so fab. La, la, la. I even managed to put mascara on without sticking the brush in my eye. Also, I tried out my new lip liner, and I think the effect definitely makes my nose look smaller. In a rare moment, I shared my nose anxiety with Mom. She said, we used to use shaders, you know, light highlights and darker bits to create shadow. You could put a light line of foundation down the middle and then darker bits at the sides to sort of narrow it down. Wrong answer, Mom. The correct answer is, you are gorgeous, Georgia, and there is nothing wrong with your nose. I didn't say that. I didn't give her the satisfaction. Instead, I said, through some toast, so I could deny it if I had to, Mom, I don't want to look like you and your friends did. I've seen the photos, and no one wants to look like ABBA anymore. 11:30 a.m. Mrs. Next Door complained about Angus again. He's been frightening their poodle. She says Angus stalks it. I explained, well, he's a Scottish wildcat. That's what they do. They stalk their prey. She said, I don't really think it should be a house-made household pet in that case. I said, he's not a household pet, believe me. I have tried to train him, but he ate his lead. There is only so much you can do with Angus. Honestly, it is really my job to deal with hysterical neighbors? Why doesn't she get a bigger dog? The stupid yappy thing annoys Angus. 1 p.m. I'd better be nice, though, otherwise I'll be accused of being a moody teenager. And the next thing you know, it'll be tap, tap, tap on my door, and Mom saying, "Is there anything you want to talk about? Adults are so noisy." Nosy. 1:30 p.m. Went next door and asked Mrs. Fussy Knickers if she wanted anything from the shops as I was going. She sort of hid behind the door. I must be nicer. I start out being nice, and then it's like someone else takes over. Am I schizophrenic as well as a lesbian? 2 p.m. Jazz phoned. She wants me to help her with part two of her plan to get Tom. The plan is subtle. Jazz and I will walk past Jennings, and as we pass the door, I will pause and then say, "Oh, Jazz, I just remembered. I said I'd get some apples. Hang on a minute." Then I'd go into the shop and buy the apples. Jazz stands behind me looking attractively casual. I smile as Tom hands over the grannies, Granny Smiths, and then, and here, is the master stroke. Or actually, as it was my idea, the mistress stroke. I say, "School in 2 days. Back to Stalag 14. Which center of boredom and torture do you go to?" Meaning, which school do you go to? Do you see? Then he tells me, and then we know how to accidentally bump into him. 4 p.m. Well, we go to Jennings, and Tom was in there. Jazz went a bit swoony. He is nice looking, I must say, with sort of crinkly hair and great shoulders. I said, "Hang on, Jazz." I promised I'd get some apples, and we went in. So she could lurk attractively behind me as planned. When he saw her, Tom looked and smiled. I asked for my grannies, and he said, "Sure. Are you looking forward to going back to school?" "Hang on a minute. Those were my lines. Still, I've done drama for 4 years, so I improvised." I rejoined, "Does the Pope hate Catholics?" He smiled, but I didn't really mean to say anything about the Pope. It just popped out. Tom went on, "Which school do you two go to?" I was just about to tell him, even though in our plan, it wasn't really his turn, when a sex god came out of the back room. I swear, he was so gorgeous, it made you blink and open your mouth like a goldfish. He was very tall and had long black hair and really intense dark blue eyes and a big mouth, and he was dressed all in black. And that's all I remember, officer. He came over to Tom and handed him a cup of tea. Tom said, "Thanks," and the sex god spoke. "Can't let my little brother slave away serving apples to good-looking girls without even a cup of tea." Then he winked at Tom and smiled at me. Then he went out the back. I just stood there, looking at the space where SG had been, clutching my apples. Tom said, "That's 40 pence. Did you tell me what school you both go to?" Well, I came out of my trance and hoped I hadn't been dribbling, and I couldn't remember. Jazz looked at me as if I had gone mad and said, "Oh, it's only the one we've been at for 4 years, Latimer and Ridgely. Which one do you go to?" 7 p.m. I am still in a state of shock. I have just met Mr. Gorgeous, and he is Tom's brother, and he is gorgeous. He saw me with my mouth open, but fortunately not without eyebrows. Oh, God. 7:05 p.m. I tried opening my mouth in the mirror, like I imagine it looked like in the shop. It doesn't make me look very intelligent, but it also doesn't make my nose look any bigger, which is a plus, of sorts. 1 a.m. I wonder how old he is. I must become more mature quickly. I'll start tomorrow. Sunday, September the 6th, 8 a.m. When I walked into the kitchen, Dad dropped his cup in a hilarious, not display of surprise, that I was up so early. What happened, Georgia? Has your bed caught fire? Are you feverish? It's not midday yet. Why are you up? I said, I came down for a cup of hot water, if that's okay. Very cleansing for the system. I must avoid a spot attack at all cost. Mom said, well, I'm off. Libby, give your big sister a kiss before we go. Libby gave me a big smacking kiss, which was nice, but a bit on the porridgey side. Still, I must get on. 10 a.m. I have completed the Cosmo Yoga Plan for inner peace and confidence. I vow to get up an hour before school and go through the 12 positions of sun worship. I feel great and 2 or 3 feet taller. The sex god will not be able to resist the new, confident, radiant, womanly me. 2 p.m. Face mask done and milk bath taken. I must try and get the milk stains off the bath towel somehow. It already smells a bit sour. Jazz rang. She thinks we should track Tom tomorrow after school. Tom, what is he to me? 4 p.m. Just discovered that Libby has used the last of my sanitary towels to make hammocks for her dolls. 4:30 p.m. She has also used all of my Starker's foundation cream on her panda. Its head is entirely beige now. And unfortunately, that's where I'm going to have to stop today because you are out of time. I hope that everyone enjoyed today's program as much as I did. And I want to say hi to all the listeners out there, and I want to encourage everyone to tune in next week when I continue with the novel, Angus, Thongs, and Full Frontal Snogging. Until then, I hope everyone has a great day and a fantastic week. So long and take care, everyone. Goodbye.